Well, it is an honor to be here, and it is exciting to meet Pastor Paul. And, you know, the topic of sexual addiction is such an interesting subject because I'm used to dealing with it. I'm used to talking about it. And I'll apologize at the beginning. You know, it's such a sensitive subject that, you know, there may be words here you haven't seen in years, and there may be words here you haven't ever seen. And yet I think that the topic is really an important one because it's something you're going to run into. I mean, if you haven't already, you're going to run into it. You're going to also know how to spot it, how to spot the symptoms without ever a person ever saying they've ever looked at pornography. You'll be able to go, wow, I wonder if they have an addictive tendency going on. And I wanted to write this so that it's not so simple that you kind of go, well, that was nice, I know. I wanted to give you as much potent medicine you feel comfortable using as Stephen ministers, you know. I'd rather have you have a little bit more skills than too little. I put this together just because I didn't want you to have to take notes, you know. I'm just going to go through not all of this, but a lot of it, and just kind of touch on that. And you can also be directed to books if you have further interest. I have a website that has issues with this. So if we were to look at, and I'm going to stand a little bit, and I'll sit and back and forth. What is sexual addiction? Well, the simple answer is when sexual behavior becomes a problem. That's the simplest thing. You know, if a couple is having sex twice a day for years and it's not a problem for them, who am I or anybody else to say, well, that's an addiction? But it's when a person takes sexuality and misuses it, that God gave it to us for procreation of children, for celebration of marriage, and some aspects of pleasure. But when it becomes my primary coping mechanism, I use it to fix a feeling, to fix my anger, to fix my fear, and then it's becoming addictive. It's also characterized by shameful events. I mean, people jokingly say, oh, I have a running addiction, you know, or I buy too many books, it's an addiction. Well, to really qualify for an addiction, it has to be a shameful thing. It's something you have to hide. So, the guy who's running or the gal who's running is not likely to sneak into their sweats without their family seeing. And maybe at midnight run out and go jogging and come back in and pretend that they haven't perspired, try to look normal. You know, no, I mean, that's not an addiction. But the sex addict, that's what you'll find, is they look and perhaps more normal than your average person. Why? Because they have some secret that they feel such shame about that they spend a lot of their time trying to look normal. So you really can't spot them, you know, by outward appearance. I mean, you'd never know. And in fact, you know, I want to also talk about, I'll be using, you know, the pronoun he, you know, because we assume that men struggle with this, but women do struggle with this. And, you know, if I'm good tonight, I'll actually try to flip-flop things so that it feels even. But just as in drinking, you know, males can drink and get drunk, and that's still not as shameful as a woman getting drunk and getting drunk. In fact, you'll see all kinds of stuff on the silver screen, the movies, and yet you still will rarely find a woman drunk on the screen. You would think of her as a lush and something worse than a man getting drunk. So it's interesting. So just take that to sexual behavior. We think of just much more of a shameful experience for the woman. And yet, it's really not about sex. In some ways, everything I'm sharing, you could apply to cocaine addiction, to food addiction, to shopping addiction, to gambling, to work, to alcoholism. It's all one and the same. And yet there's different expressions of that and different consequences for behavior. If we were to define it, and this is probably as graphic as it gets tonight, just so that you understand that, you know, it most likely than not involves masturbation. It involves phone sex, cyber sex, which is interacting with people through the internet in a sexual way. It involves pornography that can be visual stimulation. interestingly enough, some neurology people started looking at. Some guys are really triggered by visual, and they're going to struggle more with visual images. Other guys are more triggered by sound. They're going to really be triggered by phone sex. And that the guys who are very kinesthetic could be triggered with fetishes, women's underwear, and you name it. So there actually is kind of a neurology to this. And the funny thing is once they start to get through the healing and those things are a thing of the past, and they really begin to think, God, gosh, how does God speak to me? Well, some people that are visual, God speaks to in pictures. And other people, God really just, it's not an auditory, but they hear this voice. It's just neurologically how they're set up. And other people just feel God's presence. And it's kind of a kinesthetic experience. There is levels of sex addiction that are illegal. I mean, when working with someone, you could be so focused on the addiction that we forget that exposing oneself is illegal. Let's say in phone calls is illegal. Chatting on the internet and you're not knowing who you're really chatting with. If they're under 18, you've broken the law, and the FBI has had such an easy time now convicting people. And we have a whole new class of sex offenders now, which aren't the traditional sex offenders, they're just people who were chatting with a minor. So we have an evolution, and what they say is that the internet is the crack cocaine to sex addiction. You know, 20 years ago, the teenage boy or the 40-year-old male had to sneak out to a porn store to get the items. Now it just comes right into one's house. And also, just to show you what a large problem it is, and it's hard for me to believe this, but it is what the stats are showing. If you take all the revenue from porn on the internet, it outnumbers all the revenue for ABC, NBC, and CBS combined. It also outnumbers, is more than all the sports, all the basketball, all the revenue for basketball, football, and baseball. So some have suggested we wouldn't have an internet if it wasn't for the porn industry. So, and my guess is that there's just not a few people patronizing this, but it's a much more widespread problem than we have. So that's really the focus. You have other illegal behaviors of prostitution, exposing oneself, voyeuring, and a number of things. And then child molestation, which is why we usually think, oh, a sex addict meeting is probably a bunch of sex offenders. When in reality, no, you're going to find a lot of normal people. You may find people who struggle with that. But it really is a different thing. It really is a different issue going on at hand if someone's being sexual with children. And so there's a ritual involved in this. It's like there's a trance that happens before they even use. Welcome. We're talking about sexual addiction just to get you up to speed here. And the rituals are pretty neurological. Getting into the car, starting the car, going down a certain street to look for the prostitutes that stand there is all part of the ritual. Beginning to search the internet, which is kind of addictive in and of itself because there's an expanse amount of information, whether it be I'm going to search, oh, for car parts, and then you begin to search for Sports Illustrated, and then you find yourself into bikini sections. And it's part of the ritual. And so what the addict or the recovering addict doesn't realize is that they come in and they say, well, I acted out again. And that's the nice phrase we use. It's euphemistic. It's really a great phrase to use the word acting out because otherwise you're using all these terms. But acting out also really comes from the idea that we're acting out our feelings, not feeling them. It comes from adolescence. Teenagers, I think, is where they first acted out their anger by smashing a window. So when people start to recover and begin to understand that they're that behind all this there's a lot of feelings, there's a lot of stuff that's not dealt with, that recovery is going to be getting in touch with that stuff. And so they come in and passively describe, well, it just as though it just happened. The pornography left off the side of the road and opened itself, the car door, and just landed in my lap. happen. I don't know how this happened. When in reality, there's like 20 steps that led up to it, which they're usually unaware. It started maybe because their boss looked at them funny, or that their wife didn't love them enough. And so what happens is we start to ruminate and think about this and obsess on this to the point where then we start to go, well, you know, I don't think life is treating me right. We start becoming a resentment magnet, and as a result, we then find ourselves saying, you know, and this is where we start to really go unconscious, is that I don't really give a rip about anything. I'm going to pretend that I'm not married, I'm not even a Christian, and I'll amnesia the 20 to 30 to 40 other times that this same thing happened, and the person says, I'll never do this again. So what we do as therapists is try to help them see the whole, you know, the whole steps as to what happened and help them not go under into the sex trance. On page 3, you'll see the cycle of addiction. The fascinating thing about cycles, you know, is that where do you say it started? You know, and this is the same cycle you'll find with any addiction. It's also the same cycle you'll find in domestic violence. So we have at the top acting out. That is the actual behavior that's met with a sense of relief. And the relief could last days, it could last just a few minutes, just to be followed with guilt. Guilt is really about a behavior. You know, how could I have done this? Shame is how could I have done this? It's about being, it's like I'm a bad person, where guilt is I've done something bad. And so what you'll find in any addiction or even in domestic violence, which makes it hard to, it's not just hard to deal with, it's just why it keeps on cycling is the shame. Is that they feel like I'm not just a human being who has flaws, more like I'm a flawed human being. So this shame is what really, I think, propels the cycle. And that's actually not the place they think of starting with. So I try in a loving, supportive, understanding manner, try to understand what the world of the addict is like, and then they start to opening up, and the more they talk about it, the more it becomes de-shamed, and they begin to have a safe place to explore it. This follows, this leads to a depression, which usually the addict is totally unaware of. I'm not depressed, well, because it's like you're using. Take away the addiction, you know, take it away, and let's see how your real baseline mood is. So what you're going to find is as they start to get sober, by God's grace, they're going to start to deal with depression, you know. And the depression is subtle. It's also tied in with a belief system. There's four core beliefs that Dr. Patrick Carnes pointed out. He's kind of like the pioneer in the area of sexual addiction. He wrote a book called Out of the Shadows, which you'll have the resources in your notes there. He said that the sex addict, or any addict, first feels unlovable. They really feel that they're different somehow. And in that unlovability, they feel like the need to try to compensate by working really hard at getting love, and to be perfect, and to achieve, and to be popular, and all this. But so it creates this two selves where splitting starts to occur, this public image and then this private image. Then this is followed with this belief that if I share everything with you, you will reject me. So again, more splitting. They start to create a secret life, and oftentimes it can be elaborate. You know, I've heard, well, I don't want to hurt my wife, so I shouldn't tell her. Well, actually you're hurting your wife by doing the behavior, not by the telling of it. And I've heard many a spouse say, gosh, I get handle the, what he did, what I don't understand is why he just wouldn't be honest with me. And that's the nature of addiction, is we just can't be honest. And in AA, the Alcoholics Anonymous program, and the book, it suggests that, you know, a person will recover if they have the capacity to be honest. If they don't be honest, it's no real program at all, and they're not going to get any lasting sobriety, even if they're lying about anything unrelated to the addiction. I'll throw in just a tidbit. There's two types of addiction. Type 1 is the lie just about the addiction. Type 2, it's gotten so far beyond that they lie about anything. And, you know, well, where were you? Well, I was here, and they weren't there, and there's no reason to lie. But it starts to affect the brain, I think, physiologically as well as just spiritually. The third core belief is, if I depend on God or people to meet my needs, they'll let me down. So we tend not to depend on people. Addicts, you know, are dependent on the addiction. They don't realize that. But are very independent people. They'd rather use the substance than to bother anybody. The substance will be there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So the thought of going to a support group, getting a sponsor, and calling someone when they're tempted just seems like, why? You know? I don't want to do that. That's so humiliating. Well, it is. And what's interesting is the more a person can allow themselves to be, quote, humiliated. I think it was one of the writers of the early 12-step literature said that through humiliation we get humility. And through that process, they end up acquiring a virtue at the end of being very humble, really understanding that I am only sober by God's grace, and also understanding that, gosh, God is really real, because there is no way on earth I could ever say that I'm sober other than God, because I tried everything else under the sun. So that's one of the pluses of having an addiction, is at the end people really have a really close relationship with God. But at having the addiction, they really don't depend on anybody. Patrick Carn says that the addiction becomes the trusted source of comfort. Okay. Trusted meaning, you know, if push comes to shove, I kind of know what this does for me. Yes, it kicks me in the butt, but I don't know if I can risk asking for help. So this kind of brings us to, well, how do we get some of this? Well, our childhood, not to blame everything on childhood, but we know that sex addicts come from childhoods or families that have two major things going on. One is they tend to have an emotional thermostat that's like set to 55 degrees. And everybody calls this warm. And they really don't know any different. I mean, they're hardworking, providing people, my parents, and I said, well, how did they express love to you? Well, they went to work, and they fed us, and I said, well, have you ever heard I love you? Or no. You know, and so they have no idea that outside other people actually have that kind of warm, affectionate kind of experience. And so what happens is when puberty hits, all of a sudden they start to discover their sexual organs and masturbation, and for the person who's lived in such a cool, lacking in an emotional, expressive, affectionate environment, this becomes so important. They think they've found, you know, the best thing since sliced bread. So in a family that is warm and affectionate and expressive of both anger and their feelings, you're going to reduce the chances of addiction. Why? Because they already have worked out their emotional muscles. And yeah, they discover sexuality, and it's important, I guess, but not as important as the person who feels such a void. So those who have children, you know, one of the ways to help, and studies have proven this out, is that keeping an emotional connection with your children will actually help reduce the chances of them getting into drugs. So the fourth core belief is blank becomes my most important need. Meaning, in this case, sexual addiction, but it could be food, it could be drugs, it could be alcohol, it could be work, spending, gambling. And yes, the addict won't say, admit that. I mean, they'll say, no, it's not a problem at all. But if you look at their behavior, that's what they will turn to, almost like a god. That the roots of the word addiction in Latin is ad dictum, which we get the phrase, to the dictator. It's like a dictator that they become devoted to, and they do what it says, whether they think that they're controlling it, but really the tail begins to wag the dog. So we talked about the four core beliefs, and you can dig at that a little bit more on your own reading, but to move along, you know, there's different types of acting out. There's the type where it's kind of isolative. The person may have grown up as a teenager not feeling very you know, adequate about how his body turned out, kind of have some resentments there. Probably really shy, probably lonely, inward, you know, kind of fantasy-oriented. And from there, he has learned to live a vicarious life through fantasy on the internet. It's the path of least resistance. So the more he looks on the internet, the more inadequate he feels, because he's going to see unrealistic airbrush-painted people. Probably three people end up being one person. You know, no one looks like that. And from there, it's not going to cause him to go run out and ask a girl out on a date. So it's just going to create this cycle inward. On the flip-flop, you may have a sex addict who is kind of somewhat good-looking, got some strokes growing up about all that, and some girlfriends in high school, which then he begins to want to relive high school at 40. And so he's had numerous affairs. He's flirtatious in his orientation. He just almost sees everybody as sexualized. And so other men, he's usually competitive with. It's like, why would I, you know, want a friendship? So they have more friends with women. So it takes many different, I mean, I just threw out two scenarios. You know, one you have maybe coming in and the worst thing he's done is masturbation. On the other, you have someone who's broken marital vows repeatedly. You know, so you have a lot of... you know, difference in having to juggle the marital relationship. If we go to the end just temporarily, there is Appendix 2 on page 21. This is those four core beliefs, but also a little bit extrapolated in perception of self and then perception of other men and of women, you know, so just going through one of them. If we look at self-image, I'm unlovable, you know, I'm bad, I'm unworthy, shame-based. Perception of self, I'm not attractive physically or personally. A woman would not choose me. Other perception of men, other men are more attractive, more successful, and more likely to be chosen by women. Women choose men who are not like me. They prefer stronger, smarter, and more successful men. So when, you know, they start to sober up and they start using, these are the issues you're going to be working through. And it's amazing. It's really quite rewarding work to see them go from being so insecure to, gosh, I'm really pretty okay, and who cares about looks, and start to get a realistic image. They feel stronger than your average man who maybe is tangled up with lust, not to the degree of an addiction, but they go, wow, I have a better relationship to God, and I'm now more trustworthy than your average person. So that's, you know, that's an encouragement to anybody who's ever been in addiction, that... that as long as they take the medicine, you know, and one thing to consider is a shift in thinking that this is really a disease. Yes, it's a moral issue. Yes, it's sin. And yet if we look at the early church's understanding of sin, that the word salvation comes from the Greek sozo, which means also to heal. And that when Christ responds to the woman who touches the hem of his garment for healing, you know, we have one translation that says, woman, your faith has saved you, and you also have, woman, your faith has made you whole. Mm-hmm. So, you know, thinking in terms of synonymous, those synonyms, we can begin to understand that the addict comes in like a moral failure. Yes, we could go down that path, but after a while, what do you do with it? Just try harder. But if we go down that, a new path, that this is a healing, that God wants to heal you from this passion of lust, which is an inordinate sense of an misuse of sex, and he wants to restore you back to a natural state, you know, and a lot of them feel like, oh no, this is my natural state, and it's like, no, this is unnatural, and once they make that paradigm shift, it helps. Any quick questions, or should I just continue on? And I think we'll save the questions for the end, because we have a lot to... I put together personality characteristics of addiction. And again, this could relate to any addiction, but we'll go through them. And this is how you can almost spot addiction, you know. Addiction is self-medicating.
The person.
Oh, six. We're on page 6. Yeah, sorry. They are self-medicating. And this is usually the beginning stages. You know, a drinker just may have a bad day at work and drink a little. Well, he's not an alcoholic. And it doesn't feel like it's a problem, but little do they realize that they're somehow getting a medicinal effect from this. Okay? Numbing, avoidance of feeling. There is not an addict alive that doesn't have a core need to not feel the feeling. If you ask an addict, how do you feel today? And if he says, good, it means he's not feeling anything. And if he says bad, it means he's feeling something. Okay, and so what I do is, they usually have two feelings, good and bad, and once they start to realize, well, there's anger, there's worry, there's concern, there's joy, compassion, embarrassment, anger, and so they begin to get feelings 101. Shame, we talked about denial. I guess a little bit about shame and denial is if you ask someone in a session, you know, do you ever think you might have struggled with lust? Or do you think you ever struggled with alcohol? The addicts will spend the rest of the time telling you why they're not. It's like you just pushed a button and they say, well, yeah, my family had it, but I just don't really have it. And they give all these reasons. That's how you know they're probably more towards the addictive side. It's what addiction therapists call an accounting system. What they do is they hold up to themselves, I'm not a sex addict because I've never had sex with a prostitute. Who would pay for that? Now, he's maybe had 50 affairs, but that's, you know, what they, or they say, I've never had 50 affairs, but he had one or two. So there's always something worse. And what happens is give it time, and if it becomes a progressive, they start to do a behavior they never thought they would do. And so that's a good question to ask, because there are things that you never thought you would end up, you know, struggling with. It's easy to look at alcoholism as the guy shaking or the gal shaking, you know, and not making it to work. That's like less than 5% of alcoholism. And with sex addiction, you know, it can range anything from what I call mild, which is kind of like the person who's upset because they masturbate and look at porn, to the person who's gotten into some serious trouble, you know. And both of them have just as much denial. Minimizing, that's talking about it. It's just like minimizing. It's like the computer program that you just push a little button and it's still running. It's just minimized. You know? Minimizing sounds like, well, yeah, I know it's a problem, and maybe someday, you know, if it gets out of hand, then I'll kind of work on it. I know my wife is a little bit upset by this. You know, I'm sure it's a concern. Or the couple comes in, yeah, we have this issue. That's as far as they can talk about it. It's just an issue. I had, heard lots of people talk about, they kind of take the actual behaviors and minimize them. So, like, I went to a latte stand and I got a latte and I was kind of triggered. Okay, that's kind of a nice phrase to use. So, you can feel like a voyeur yourself by asking, well, what exactly happened? Well, she wears a real tight sweater. Or she's been known to flash if you put extra tip. Yeah. Okay, and so then when you begin to discover, well, how old is she? Well, I think she's 17. So in actuality, you paid a minor to show her your breast, or her breast. And they just like, you feel like oxygen mask needs to come out of the ceiling to help them. But that's what minimizing does, is it helps them stay alive. And again, you can feel mean as a therapist doing this. You have to do it with care and concern. But, you know, just stating the facts, you know. Normalizing is, you know, talking about it. But it's like, well, every guy struggles with this. There are book titles, I'm sure, that, you know, I won't get out of soapbox. But there are book titles that make it sound like it's every man's struggle. And it isn't every man's struggle. You know, that just is going to help sell the book, and it normalizes it, you know. Blaming. This is where, well, if you had my wife and we have such little sex life, you know, I ended up, you know, masturbating in the car while driving. You know, and when you hear that, it's hard not to laugh because you would go, well, gosh, you know. That's no excuse, but that's real life. That's how they perceive it. Otherwise, no one says, I'm going to go do this to hurt my family and children. I'm going to cut off my relationship with God by doing this awful deed. No, it has to have an elaborate system as to why this is somehow justified. And so gently, we kind of cut some of the strings of how it fell together. Okay. And the irony is that the wife or the spouse can feel like, well, I don't. I mean, I'm the cause of all this. I should have been much more loving, much more attractive, much more whatever. And the gift from the Al-Anon program helps us with this. They say there's the three C's. I didn't cause it. I can't control it, and I can't cure it. So when I have couples come in, you know, I bring that up, and she may say, yeah, I really believe that, but there are times when, you know, I'm sure that she struggles with that, and he unconsciously pushes buttons to make her feel like, well, we should have sex so that I don't act out, and that's not the goal of recovery. Recovery is so that sex can become optional, that we have choice over it versus a compulsive quality. Many an addict thinks that they're in their histories, their first steps, that it'll be cured once they get married. And it's just not the case. Grandiosity. You could find the grandiosity of the addict who does wonderful things and everything's better than life. But grandiosity can be subtle. Oh, I can get from here to Seattle in 20 minutes. You know, well, that's not reality, at least in this day and age. Yeah. But they think like that, and so then they're always stressed, overworked, overtired, because they really don't know how to be just a human being. They become bigger than that, what we call ego inflation, which is probably one of these. And so that's why humility and shrinking down to ego, to understanding we have limits and I can get my feelings hurt. What happens is the grandiosity also takes the form of, oh, I'm not hurt. You know, and anybody else can tell this should hurt you, but no, they're not allowed to hurt, perhaps because of the dysfunctional family, you know. Low self-esteem, that's pretty obvious, but you won't see it. And one of the jokes is that an addict or an alcoholic has the uncanny sense of being grandiose and low self-esteem at the same time. And it's kind of true. controlling, you will find that one of the trademarks of addiction is having a sense of controlling the environment so that I find serenity inside myself. And that I want to run the whole show, and so in running the whole show, I may be very virtuous. I may be giving, compassionate. Why? Because I need to make people happy, and if people are happy around me, then I'm happy. Or I may be kind of on the self-centered side of it, where I just want what I want, and people don't give it to me. And so, you know, when Christ says that the kingdom of God is within you, the recovery message is to go inside and to realize there are things you cannot change and things you cannot control. And then there are things you can change, which is usually ourselves, believe it or not. And then there's wisdom to know the difference, and that sounds like the serenity prayer. The irony is an unrecovered addict is trying to control all the things they cannot change. And they're not even going near the things that they actually could. Codependency, you can almost spot addiction by the spouse. If she talks, thinks, fixes, helps, manages, you have to go, well, why is she over-functioning? And this could be reversed. I mean, why is this man controlling this woman? And deep down, she has a hidden addiction, you know, putting alcohol in the commuter mug as the kids are getting off to school. So, black and white thinking. I jokingly say that addiction kills all the reasonable brain cells. You know, what are left is the unreasonable ones. That there's really not a black. There's really black and white. It's not really gray. There's just not much room for moderate expressions. If I'm going to have a jelly bean from the bag, I'm going to eat the whole bag. Versus moderation. Anger, you'll find that more often there is anger. Either it's expressed, and in the cycle, you can almost find out when it happened. Sometimes they get really angry at their family right after using. They're mad at themselves that they project it on. Or they get really angry before using. They set it up so they can have a spousal fight, and then instead of running to the bar, he's running to the computer. Okay. Quick fix mentality. Addicts want it, and they want it now. It's amazing, you know, the signs along the side of the road, you know, lose 50 pounds in 2 days, you know. What they don't realize is that's going to appeal to the person who struggles with food because it's a quick fix. And that's why we want to lose the weight in 2 days, where recovery is all about the slow, arduous process of personality kind of reconstruction and spiritual healing. So it takes a while to help. I mean, I have sessions where they come in, they're crying, gosh, this is awful. I'll never really do this again, and my wife's willing to give me a second chance. Yes, I'll go to meetings. Yes, I'm going to write out my first step. The second meeting, I feel so much better. You're the most wonderful therapist. You know, maybe the wife's not there, and have you gotten a book? Oh, yeah, I'm reading it, and have you gotten to meeting? Well, I don't know, and it takes a while to do these things. By the third meeting, it's like, you know, I feel great. I haven't acted out in a long time, actually 2 weeks. I just know that I'm on the right road, and thank you. It's kind of a simplistic, I'll just stop. Well, sure, and there are people that can do that. I haven't met many of them. And if, who am I to say that they couldn't just stop? My guess is that if they really had the addiction, they'll either pick it up again or pick up another addiction, or be what is termed the dry drunk, which is not really pleasant to live with, which leads us to the disease of perception and the disease of disconnection. I mean, if a person can use these substances, setting all the morality aside, I mean, what's the big problem? Well, the problem is that it's a disease of relationship. It's a disease of perception. That the person is not geared to seeing and seeing reality and hearing reality and staying in touch with reality. That through the minimizing, normalizing, even just trying to have a conversation with them, they get defensive, not even about addiction, but about other stuff. Well, you told me to fix the garage, and you should have done that, and so, or procrastination is happening. Well, I'm working hard at this, or it's just a disease of our eyesight, and that recovery, and the word sober means to really see reality, to really feel what is real. In Proverbs, I want to say 29 or 30, it talks about alcoholism. And it talks about a man who's given too much wine, who lingers over it, looks at the red when it sparkles, that in the end it stings like a viper, and that he is like a man at the top of the mast of a ship, and through the winds and the storms of life it's beating him, and he says, but I did not feel it. You know, I didn't, I'm not getting hurt, and when can I wake up to find another drink? You know, so that we have in Scripture there, addiction is that disease of perception. Probably more problematic is the disease of disconnection. That they're connecting with a substance that's taking them away from really connecting with their family. They're like in a bubble. They're like in their own world where there's a sense of connection, but it's kind of abbreviated. And usually the family goes, there's something not right. I mean, we try to reach out, we try to connect, but it's just like Teflon. And so this is what really causes the issues. So what brings people into treatment? On page 9, you know, the crisis. Rarely does a person say, well, I'm just tired of this. I think I'll better my life. You know, so I'm just going to give this up. No, it's usually an arm-twisting, foot-dragging kind of session where the spouse is bringing them in and said, it's enough, I can't. You know, you said you were going to stop 3 times ago, and I now realize this is a pattern, and if you could have done this yourself, you would have by now. What's neat is the Chinese use a character for the word crisis is the same as the word opportunity. And it really is an opportunity for healing. Many an addict looks back on their bottoming out experience with some fondness of, gosh, yeah, that was the best of times, but it was also the worst of times. But it was the best in that it got them into recovery. So there's usually some kind of crisis, some personal confrontation, some arrest, getting fired from work. They looked at, I mean, the pornography automatically downloaded itself because the gentleman looked at it, and so it downloaded itself again, put it on the background, and so when his lady colleague pushes the screen, up comes the stuff, and within a couple of hours he has a box in his hand and he's leaving. And, you know, not, you know, without any addict, but, you know, he's not going to do this ever again, and then he finds himself doing it at his next job. So there's that disease of perception. It's like, how many chances is God going to give us? So once a person dedicates themselves to taking the medicine, they're going to get better. It's not a matter of just trying harder. Denial. We talked a lot about denial, but there is this working it through and writing out a timeline out of all the stuff they've done. They can see patterns. I have yet to have a gentleman write it out. It's kind of just like a timeline on the board, starting with you. You know, what was your first experiences? It needs to be specific, but not necessarily graphic. It can be coded, but it's something we go over together. By going through it, I did not realize how much of a thing this was. And so you can expect some depression, almost despair. In 12 steps, in step two, they say we came to believe a power greater than ourselves will restore us to sanity. There is such depth and mystery in these steps. They say first we came, meaning we came to the meeting, to the therapist's office. Then we came to. Then we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. So the coming to process is the getting out of this denial. And if they just come to without coming to believe that God will restore them, you're going to hit despair. They're going to say, I don't know if I could ever get out of this. I'm not sure I can handle this. And that's where you, as a minister, can really encourage them, you know, to realize God can restore whatever mess you think you've made. And it is a mess. To sanity. And sanity is defined by doing those things that help us, not continuing to do the same thing over and over expecting a different result. Yeah. Motivation. Motivation is going to come into play by having them stay in enough pain and enough of the crisis mode to stay committed to the process. Patrick Carnes, which I didn't get the opportunity to outline here, but he, you know, works with the severe addicts in the hospitals, and he came up with 30 tasks. Anything from, like, getting through denial, sexual history timeline, first step, fourth step of the 12-step model, a physical, doing joint therapy, working through childhood stuff. Out of these 30 tasks, he found that if people did, I think, just 18 of them, that 93% the people in the study were sober after 2 years. Okay? So that there's actual tasks that if one just does, they'll get better. And what's neat is it validates what we've been sharing for years. So going to a 12-step meeting, you've heard me talk about 12 steps, you know, just like in treatment for alcoholism, no doubt that the treatments of addiction and alcoholism, that the medical and the spiritual and the psychological would come together, like, you know, when doctors said, we can't help you, go to AA, you know, when treatment centers were $12,000 and they put people in a van, take them down to the street for the free AA meeting, you know, what a scam. I mean, that's, you know it works then, you know, but AA doesn't claim to do stats and results, but, you know, there's an AA meeting probably every hour of this day. I mean, we're talking probably 50 meetings, you know, maybe 3 and 4 at 6 in the morning, 5 and 6 of them at 7 in the morning, at 8 in the morning. I mean, I'm not kidding. There's a little book like you wouldn't believe. So for sex addiction, it has grown to where there's probably a meeting every night in this general location. There's some during the day, some at noon. You can go to, I listed some websites there, or you can type in Sex Addicts Anonymous or Sexaholics Anonymous or Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. It's interesting that they kind of broke up into three different camps. Well, they didn't break up. I scratched that. That's misinformation. They each kind of evolved at the same time, but they each had kind of separate focus. The traditional marriage, sex inside of marriage, and a loving, committed relationship, and anything outside of that, and any masturbation, any pornography, you would find that as the definition of sobriety in SA, Sexaholics Anonymous. There is a group, Sex Addicts Anonymous, and I'm just educating you on, you know, the various groups here. Sex Addicts Anonymous is a good group, but they would have you define your own sobriety. So if you were to send someone to Sex Addicts Anonymous, you might find that the person there might be involved in behaviors such as how you could be sober, but that's how they define it. You know. And then Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, it's the same kind of principle. You kind of define it yourself. There is love addiction, which I'm not really focused too much on, but just to say a little bit. Love addiction afflicts, I think, women a little bit more than men, but it's more the fantasy, it's more the addictive relationship where we get numbed by thinking, fixing, rescuing. It sounds a little bit like codependency, but it really has this sexual fantasy twist to it. So it's characterized by a lot of affairs and all these relationships. And usually that if there were meetings, SLAA, you're going to find more women. So that's something to consider if you're recurring. I let people decide where they want to go. I just tell them, you know, here are the various groups, and they kind of pick and choose. And the last thing they want to do is go to a meeting. I mean, they spent their life kind of being solitary. I can fix it myself, thank you. Why would I go to a meeting and even talk about this? And what are those people going to be like? I mean, you have to admit, you know, oh, I'm going to a sex addict meeting. Oh, okay. You know, you can raise your hand in church, and I'm 20 years sober in AA, and everybody's going to clap. If you say I'm 20 years sober in sex addict, they're going to kind of move away and hold their children, you know. So, you know, there's still that stigma attached to that. So, and to be delicate, you know, when they come in and they describe all the behaviors, and I say, well, you know, this looks like sex addiction, and it could be. I use these nice. It could be something to explore, but the poor spouse is that I mean, I'm just trying to get over what I caught him doing on the internet. And now to hear that he's a sex addict, I don't know if I even want to go there. You know, and so you have to be very delicate when talking about it, because some spouses, the addict may say, you know what, this is it. You've defined it, and she may be going, I don't want to know about it. Just recover, you know. So you have some of those issues. But once they get to a meeting, you'll find elements of meeting where it's kind of scripted. They read from a book, so there's no real leader. There's no real money, although there's money for rent. You're going to find this idea of sponsorship, which I think is really vital. From a psychological point of view, the sponsor becomes that new trusted source of comfort. Once the addict, through humility, can make the phone call to the sponsor, who really does love them and care about them, can carry the message but really can't carry the addict, has been there and has some sobriety, and it offers hope and encouragement. And when, you know, a person is shaking, you know, from using, you know, they're afraid to call the phone sex people, but then they're also just as afraid to call their sponsor, and then they make the transition to calling the sponsor, talking it out, then they've moved from acting it out to actually talking it out. And in a way, it's like the parents or big brother they've never had. So it's a beautiful relationship. The irony is you would think, gosh, this is just a setup for a controlling, codependent relationship. You know, I don't know why, but it doesn't really happen that often. I mean, maybe, I've seen it maybe 1%. It's just odd. It's just that if people really, it's like scripture, if they douse themselves in the scripture and the traditions, they find that they're not going to get into weird dynamics of trying to keep their sponsee sober. you know. And you have sponsors that are tough as nails, that don't have a lot of time, and if you want to get sober, do exactly what I tell you. It's kind of like the spiritual father of the early church. And then you have sponsors that will let the person do whatever they want. I mean, it's not even a letting, it's just, you know, it's up to you, it's your program. If you want to call me daily, go ahead and call me daily. They're not, I'm saying it kind of tough. But they're not really so hands-on. So you'll hear about that in working with people.
You will find that there's literature. There's AA, which
you, if you ever want to get literature, I recommend buying it at Half Price Books. I'm thinking I'm getting someone's book who didn't want it, you know, or I think once a person's really in recovery, they're going to keep it. So all these are used. I pick this up. And in fact, I tend to, maybe there's a little bit codependent on my part, but you know, the $3, $4, $5. I usually carry an extra copy just to get it into the hands of someone faster. And they can borrow it. And once they start reading it, they go, my gosh, this is pretty profound. So this is the 12 steps and 12 traditions. I'll pass that around. This is the first book that came out on sexual addiction, Out of the Shadows. He was really criticized, and technically, sex addiction does not exist in terms of any diagnostic manual. It just doesn't exist. Neither does alcoholism. You have alcohol abuse, alcohol dependence. So, you know, this is kind of a different model than the psychological world. And yet we have a whole cluster of symptoms that most every therapist would say, yeah, this all fits together, but it's never been classified as such. There's a lot of research on it, but it just has never been diagnosed. So if you run into people with court situations or a custody battle, you know, get them to a professional or someone, you know, but I remind them, this is not diagnosable. So it actually helps safeguard their notes and stuff. And that's why I, you know, when taking notes, do you take notes or are you encouraged not to take notes as a Stevens minister or?
No.
Yeah, so you're really out of the loop. It's a wonderful relationship to have because then they can share anything with you. Probably the exception would be child abuse. You might have some kind of mandated reporting there, but they can share with you. Where therapists now end up taking notes, and so we have to be very cryptic so that it protects their confidentiality. Because, you know, the day in court battles between parenting, they'll try to go after anything. And believe me, one of the most upsetting things is when there's a divorce where there's been a sex addict and that wife has a legitimate concern about the safety of children. The problem is it can kind of get ugly. And so it's not a fun thing. This is Sex and Love Addict Anonymous. I don't have the essay. Sexaholics Anonymous book with me or the Sex Addict Anonymous book, but this is, and you'll find that each chapter is devoted to a certain step. You'll find at the end of each book, it's the actual script for how the meeting's done. So it really is, they say self-help groups, but it's really God-centered. They really feel that God is their leader, is expressed in a group conscience. That, and I love what one gentleman who's clergy as well as the licensed addict put it, you know, because we as Christians know who God is. But what about this higher power thing? And he said it best. He said that God himself is anonymous in this program. Out of love for mankind, that any addict who is struggling, that all they have to do is start to reach out beyond themselves to God, and God is going to begin to heal and reveal himself, you know, even if they think that it's just an impersonal higher power. And I've seen many people start by going to a 12-step and end up in church as a result. This is more for the spouse. There are some books. I have to say, this one you could read, and it can, it's so graphic as well as the worst-case scenario that it can traumatize someone. You know, he may be a mild sex addict, and this talks about rape situations, and so then she gets mad at him. How could you? No, this is just, you know, and so you have to be careful. This one's the book for S-Anon, and there are, like, Al-Anon groups. S-Anon has their groups. So you'll hear about, and we're at 8 o'clock. What is the time? frame. Just kind of wrapping it up here. Okay, so I'm going to... Yeah, that's what I thought. So what you're going to find is you're going to hear about steps, step work. Step one is a biggie where they're writing out their powerless experience. Fourth step, if there was a heart of the program, it deals really with resentments and fears. Okay, that is the fear and resentment that fuels their addiction. Let me, in closing, deal a little bit with what some of these charts in the back. The first one, Appendix 1 on page 16, this is really fun. It teaches you how to listen for the problem. Those issues of denying, manipulation, accusing, lying, threatening, judging, projection, blaming, humor. It gives actual scripts of what you'll hear people say. Like the alcoholic who just got a DUI, projection is going to say, I think my wife is the one who really has the problem. You really ought to work with her. Okay, that's projection. Humor, well, gosh, this isn't that bad. You know, and they kind of laugh about it. The second appendix is that belief chart. Three is really important. I use it a lot. This is where they write out the short-term and long-term benefits or losses if they were to continue to use. This really works well for adolescents. In fact, you could use this for anything. So if I say, if you continue to use this substance, what are the short-term benefits? Well, there's nothing. And it's like, well, no, let's get honest. You know, maybe it's stress relief. It feels good for about 20 minutes or whatever it is. And I really try to have them go to task with writing that out. Now, long-term benefits? Then they draw a blank. Well, there is none. There's no long-term benefits of me using. What about short-term losses? Well, they're going to feel guilty. They're going to worry about how this is affect. And long-term losses? Well, I could die from this. I could get disease. I could get arrested. I could lose money. Then I also have them do it for staying sober. What are the short-term benefits of staying sober? Well, as painful as it is, at least I feel better. You know, long-term benefits? That's a big thing. They're going to write a lot on what are the long-term benefits of not having to live a double life, no more lying. Short-term losses? Okay, a little bit of stress and anxiety. It's not going to be fun trying to detox from this. Long-term losses? There is none. Okay, from staying sober. Appendix 4, it's a daily renewal. This is really useful when people slip or they need that shot in the arm. These are the questions that they can ask themselves. Are you willing to admit you're powerless over this? If they're not willing to admit powerlessness, it means they're trying to do it and they're not going to really stay sober. And then Appendix 5 deals with some resources, how you can connect on the internet. You know, I have to warn you, when you type in sex addiction, you can come up with some unsavory sites. If you have a strong filtering, it might block the good sites. So it takes a while to find these places.
These places. The Appendix 6 deals with a optimal health down to high risk in terms of understanding what are the triggers and what are the situations that affect an addict. In closing, I would like to share a story that comes from the early church in the Desert Fathers of the 3rd century. There are two monks that go out to the city to get supplies, and they become separated. When they come back, one says to the other, "You know, I can't go back. I've sinned, I've committed fornication. There's no way that God can forgive me." And the other one, quick thinking, says, "You know what? I am so glad you mentioned this. The same happened to me. Let us go back and repent together, and surely God will forgive us." And they go to the monastery, and they repent, and they go through that process, that healing process. And God reveals to the abbot that, in fact, one of these men did not sin, but out of great love for his brother, took his own sin as if it was his own and repented with him. And because of this, God forgave this brother and healed him from the power of lust in his life. So as we take these skills that we've learned, let us consider how we can take the sins of our brothers and, in essence, repent with them. Thank you.